Lecture 15, Natural Law and the Founding Fathers.
So far, we have been pursuing the theory of natural law as it has been evident on the continent of Europe. But in this lecture, I'd like to turn here to America, for the theory of natural law has played a very interesting role in the thought of our founding fathers as they created this very interesting experiment in representative democracy upon these shores. Our founding fathers knew of the theory of natural law, not only from John Locke, whom we were discussing in the last lecture, but also from the use of natural law in the long tradition of English jurisprudence. Our Declaration of Independence, for instance, cites at one point nature and nature's God, and then proceeds to an enumeration of various natural rights. Likewise, the U.S. Constitution bears some of the signature marks of natural law theory, as well as its own Bill of Rights, where there are a specific enumeration of the rights that John Locke himself would have talked about in his theory of natural law. In addition, one finds natural law theory evident in the Constitution and in its subsequent history, where we have given to the Constitution such a supreme role in the notion of law as it's understood here, not just because it has been something that gained the consent of the people and the states, but I think out of that natural law recognition that this Constitution, in certain important ways, embodies the eternal and immutable principles of natural justice. What I'd like to do in this lecture, then, is to focus for a few minutes on some of the direct sources of natural law theory as our founding fathers knew them, and then, secondly, turn briefly to the Declaration of Independence, and then for a slightly longer period to consider our Constitution and a bit of the development of constitutional ideas in this country. First, the Declaration of Independence and its sources. It was written by Thomas Jefferson and then adopted by the Second Continental Congress, and that Declaration of Independence relies very much on one specific version of natural law, namely the theory of natural law as articulated by John Locke, not only because of the way in which the natural rights claims are enumerated in our Constitution, but also because of a very specific natural right which John Locke had talked about and which we were discussing at the end of the last lecture, namely the natural right of a people to rebel when there is no other way to redress violations of that people's other natural rights. I point out, though, that in commenting and saying that John Locke's theory is so influential for the Declaration and for the Constitution, that this is one version of natural law. And as we have seen earlier on in this course, there have been some other very strong versions, in particular the one championed by the Stoics at the end of antiquity, and then the one developed by Thomas Aquinas at the height of the Middle Ages. When I try to think about natural law and its history and try to locate the American founding fathers within that tradition, I think it's helpful to think about this as being yet one more species in a much larger genus. It's clearly recognizably the same sort of animal, but there's also something particular and distinctive about it. And what I think is so particular and distinctive about the American version and puts it squarely in the camp of John Locke is its emphasis upon natural rights. And when you see that tradition, you can, I think, be fairly secure in saying that this is one species, but a different species, of the larger theory of natural law. Now, what were the sources of our founding fathers? Besides Locke, whom they had read in his second treatise on government, there are also a number of British jurists who are extremely important to understanding the American use of natural law theory, in particular the British jurists Edward Coke and William Blackstone. They discuss at some length in their various commentaries on British common law the possibility of having the judiciary enforce certain natural law limits on legislation. That is, they don't have anywhere nearly the activist jurisprudence that later emerged at points in our constitutional history, but they certainly raise the prospect and the possibility of having the jurists, of having jurisprudential limits on legislation. In doing so, what we find in the course of their writings are particular claims about natural law which our American founding fathers knew. Always, I think we should balance these British jurists with the theory of John Locke, And from John Locke, we see in the Declaration of Independence and in other writings references to a set of inalienable natural rights, as our Constitution has it, a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we hear there, I think, the echoes of John Locke, who spoke of the natural rights of life, liberty, and property. Now, it's interesting when we hear that language from Locke and echoed in these other writers of British jurisprudence, it's interesting to think about that term inalienable for a minute. Inalienable is one way in which to talk about these rights as natural. That is, they come to us not by virtue of a gift of the community. They come to us not by virtue of law or legislation itself. They come to us not because of power. They come to us not because of a claim we're making. The claim of an inalienable right, it is that it is inalienable. That is, it is something that cannot be taken away from us by force of power or by legislation, nor is it something that we can voluntarily surrender. And when one thinks through that claim of these rights of being inalienable, one will see how deeply steeped we are in the tradition of nature. What are we to make of that difference between the Lockean formulation, life, liberty, and property, as opposed to Jefferson's formulation, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? It may be that the difference is simply rhetorical, that Jefferson thought that he could gain a greater sway and find a formulation that would be more easily acceptable to those who were property owners and to those who were not. On the other hand, it could also be that Jefferson is making some particular significant statement in the matter. And so we look elsewhere in the writings of Jefferson and look in terms of who he's quoting to see what he may have meant by choosing happiness rather than property. One finds, for instance, that before the Continental Congress had convened, and when Jefferson was still thinking about the language he was intending to propose, that he didn't discuss these rights in terms of inalienability. Rather, he spoke of them as being sacred and inviolable, and then later turned to the notion of inalienable, as well as chose the language of happiness, perhaps echoing even the Aristotelian tradition and its strong sense of happiness as a natural end of human species. When one looks at those jurists, for instance, Sir Edward Coke, one is going further back in history and seeing some of the sources that were well known to these American jurists. Edward Coke's book is called The Institutes, and then later, The Reports. It's a very standard work on British law and was very prominent until the publication of Blackstone's own commentaries. In particular, two cases come up again and again when American founding fathers are reading their Coke. One is called Calvin's case that comes from the year 1608. And just to read an important line from that tradition, it says, "The law of nature cannot be changed or taken away," and, quote, "should direct this case." Another case that he cites, and which our American founding fathers read of and talk about in their own literature, is Bonham's case from 1609. This is a very interesting case about the practice of law within the city limits of London, and whether the equivalent of the British Medical Association at that period had to license a doctor, and whether there could be a law against practicing medicine without a license. And in deciding in favor of the doctor and against the claim that there could be a law preventing the practice of medicine without a license, the case was decided on this principle: the common law will control the acts of Parliament and sometimes adjudge them to be utterly void. Now, this is important because it's a sense that there is a higher law than statute law, a sense of natural right and natural wrong, something that is recognized by the common law and is, in fact, the basis of the common law. And for a person like Edward Coke to cite it and then American jurists to cite him is a recognition that they're thinking in terms of this higher law tradition. A little later on, Sir William Blackstone wrote a book called Commentaries on the Laws of England. It's published in 1765, and when one thinks of the dates, this is a new hot ticket, a bestseller in legal circles in the time just before our American Revolution. And one finds in Blackstone both an advertence to natural law as well as a sense of the utter and absolute supremacy of Parliament. Now, those are irreconcilable positions, and sometimes, in lawyers' minds, it's okay that you have irreconcilable traditions and that the jurist will assent to one or the other of these traditions as they need in the pragmatic order. One finds in Blackstone both traditions. For example, at one point he says, "This law of nature, being coeval with mankind and dictated by God himself, is superior in obligation to all others. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this." Now, again, that's a very strong natural law assertion, and Blackstone is citing it, and our American founding fathers at the time of the Revolution liked to cite this precisely because it was a sense that the British laws, which they thought were unfair and a further complication, the lack of any representation that they had before the British Parliament, now gave them, under Lockean rules, a right to revolution precisely because the higher law was not being observed, and in fact the laws made by Parliament were directly against their own natural rights. On the other hand, one also finds in Blackstone a strong sense that the law of Parliament is absolute and that it may make laws on any subject whatsoever. Here I think one hears in Blackstone and in this tradition of British jurisprudence, one hears the echo of the enormous importance which British law has always accorded to the Magna Carta and to the restraint of the powers of the king by increasing the powers of the legislature. And hence, since they don't ever want to go back to a power of the king which has surpassed the legislature, they end up asserting the absolute supremacy of the legislature, hoping, I think, with good British optimism, that the legislature will behave itself and will observe the natural law, and hence that there will be no conflict. But in fact, there is no intrinsic resolution of this conflict within their system, and you simply have principles which are at the furthest extreme incompatible. What might Blackstone have meant when he's thinking about this natural law or higher law tradition? This is hard to say because Blackstone is enough of a philosopher to be quoting Stoic authors at various points and quoting Aristotle, and yet to be given this tradition of the happiness which Jefferson eventually includes, replacing the language of Locke, namely the natural rights of life, liberty, and property, replacing that with terminology about the natural rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, one finds in Blackstone the frequent use and reference to happiness as being a natural end of humankind. On the other hand, when he does so, when one reads the relatively voluminous part of his works on that, one finds that he has emptied happiness out of any particular Aristotelian context where there is a natural end for humankind, and he's emptied it of any theological sense. It's not as though there's a happiness in the next world for which this life is a preparation. There is rather a much stronger sense in Blackstone that this is personal happiness. It's the happiness that comes from doing as we will, from doing as one likes. Hence, there's just a bit of a range of possibilities there in Blackstone that one can interpret these passages in either way. Jefferson does pick up on the language and takes a very high moral note when he sounds the theme of an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Interestingly, Blackstone does envision some strong limits on the rights of property. When one thinks, for instance, of property rights in this country, one of the places where property rights come to be curtailed is in the practice of eminent domain, when a government may take land, for instance, for a highway or for some other government institution where they need a given person's land. And Blackstone is one who justifies the practice of eminent domain so long as proper compensation is paid. And he does so on an interesting natural law line of reasoning, namely that the consent of the property holder has been given to the government if the government is legitimate, even if the consent has only been given by one's representative to the legislature. So Blackstone is trying again to balance these things, and I think comes up ultimately with a natural law kind of reasoning to justify a limit on property. And I think this was probably fairly influential for Mr. Jefferson. Now, when we turn to the text of the Declaration itself, one finds there natural law language, especially in the opening phrases with the reference to nature and nature's God. And one of the great questions, of course, that has come to scholars about our American Declaration of Independence concerns whether this is, for instance, the God of Christianity, or is this perhaps just a very vague deist vision of God? I won't try to settle that question here, since our project is largely to consider natural law, and hence I find it simply interesting that we have a reference to nature first and then to the God of nature. This allows the notion of a creator, but it doesn't particularly specify which theory. My own view on the matter is that Jefferson recognized that America, the American colonies at this time, were a relatively religious set of communities, but that there was variety in American religion, and that it ranged across quite a considerable range of Christianity. And I think that what he was doing was looking simply for the most acceptable possible language, what would draw in as many of the colonists to the revolution which was now being declared. And so we have a relatively generic approach. And interestingly, natural law allows that common basis. And this has always been one of natural law's strengths, namely that it doesn't claim particularly to have any one ecclesial backing, but rather is something that is accessible to any person who have open mind and reasonable inclination to see that there is a God who ought to be worshipped and to see that there is a nature within us which is the source of various moral obligations, including obligations of a political nature as well as rights of a political nature. On this subject, I'd like in particular to recommend a very, very wonderful volume by Edwin Corwin, written earlier in this century. Corwin's volume is entitled The Higher Law Background of American Constitutional Law, and he gives a wonderful account of the Declaration as well as of the U.S. Constitution in terms of some of the natural law concepts that are found in the Declaration of Independence. What one sees in that declaration is a tremendous assertion of natural rights, rights which the American colonists thought to have been historically theirs on their basis of being Englishmen, as well as on their basis of simply being human. That is, that they balance the notion of the common law of England and the natural law precisely in order to stress the legitimacy of their claim and the illegitimacy of legislative control, of legislative activity, without the consent of the governed, and that is the situation in which they find themselves. One interesting question, though, that comes up is, how about slavery? On natural law grounds, as we saw a lecture or two ago, there was, at least in Baroque scholasticism, among some of those Dominican and Jesuit authors of the 16th and 17th centuries, a readiness to condemn slavery as against the natural law. Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration actually does condemn slavery, and this is very interesting given that Jefferson himself was a slaveholder. Perhaps it was a recognition in his own part, on his own mind, that slavery was a violation of the natural right to freedom and liberty. But the passage got removed by the Second Continental Congress, presumably out of a desire not to weaken the cause of independence by alienating slave owners. In a way, this shows the problem with legislation by committee and a strong sense of the difficulties that come when one is forced to compromise on moral principle. When one makes a compromise, especially of this magnitude, one may be simply building in conflict later, as we saw in the history of our republic with the war that was eventually fought on that subject, among other reasons, for the Civil War. Jefferson may well have had a stronger sense of this, but was unable to maintain his position in the Congress, and at one point in the course of his letters, he tells us that the fact of slavery in his country haunted him, quote, like a fire bell in the night. Indeed, he says, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice will not rest forever. A strong sense, I think, in Jefferson of his trouble over that particular issue. Let me turn now to the Constitution of the U.S., for it too reflects a number of important natural law concepts. But in addition to the fact that there is explicit reference to some of these concepts in our Constitution, I'd also like to keep our minds focused on the fact that the Constitution enjoys such a tremendous supremacy, such a tremendous high regard, and ask the question about whether this is out of simply a social contract devotion to a document that we've agreed on, or, as I would rather suggest, not only that, but also that this supremacy rests on the fact that the Constitution embodies principles of natural justice. And I would want to contend that that is actually the more important and significant factor. When one is looking at any country's basic law, whether it be in the form of a written constitution such as ours is, or an unwritten constitution such as England has, whether one is looking at a code, for instance, as was long the case in France or is still the case in Louisiana, one finds a fundamental nature to this law. But one can always ask about that country's history and to see, does that basic law have a really high regard? Is it something that is venerated? And in our country, I think the answer to that is yes, it clearly does. As one reads the history of jurisprudence over our 220-some years, especially in the first 80 years, it had a regard that was tantamount to being sacred. I think that after that first period of 80-some years, I think you see the language of jurists being tempered much more, and especially as you see activist courts emerge, then there's a much stronger sense that we need to adapt this document to new conditions. Now, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, it's a change, in any case, in the original understanding of it. Let's consider for a moment the opening lines of the Constitution, and near the beginning, one finds the language that this Constitution has been ordained by the people of the United States. Now, that can be read in an entirely voluntarist sense. And as we were stressing a couple of lectures ago, in the history of the tradition of law and thinking about law, there are intellectual strands and voluntarist strands. That is, law might be right because it embodies what reason directs us for the common good, the reason of God, the reason of the human legislator. Or it can be voluntarist. Law can be law because chosen by God, or chosen by the people, or chosen by the legislatures as an act of strength and will. This language, near the beginning of our Constitution, ordained by the people of the United States, can, of course, be read in an entirely voluntarist sense, as if the law were simply an expression of the commands of the human lawgiver and an expression of the will of the people, the highest possible source for legitimacy and autonomy. Especially in the tradition of Locke and of Montesquieu, I think you have a sense that the voluntarist tradition is strong here, namely that societies are organized by a social contract when people in a state of nature come together. In the other and older traditions of natural law that we were considering, even states and governments and societies have a nature. The form of it may be devised by human institution, but it's an entity with a nature in its own right. So one way of reading this is to say that this is a commitment to the voluntarist sense of the legitimacy and authority of our government and of our Constitution. But I would submit to you that the claim that the real supremacy and legitimacy of the U.S. Constitution as coming solely from its rootedness in popular will is a theory of more recent origin. It's a theory, I think, that is subsequent to the American Civil War and much more prominent in our recent jurisprudence. And I think it's forgetful of the higher law background from Cook and Blackstone and the tradition that is antecedent to John Locke. Because I think that higher law background was operative for the founders of the American Republic. For our American founders, the supremacy of a constitution, and the reason why they wrote a constitution rather than simply rest upon an unwritten constitution such as England had, the supremacy of a constitution comes precisely from its content. That is, from the way in which a given constitution, and they had many from which they could have chosen, the way in which a given constitution embodies in so many words the essential and unchanging demands of justice. And then what the people do when they choose the constitution is give witness to how good a job that constitution does in embodying the principles of justice. Hence, I would maintain that that phrase from the opening of the constitution, ordained by the people of the United States, is not so much direct social contract language as fundamental affirmation that we believe that the Constitution which was written does embody these principles of natural justice and the long-standing and older tradition of the natural law. And especially when one reads the Federalist Papers, one sees them making these philosophical arguments all the time. Among the natural law concepts that are most prominent in the Constitution and in subsequent constitutional history are the following four, namely, the superiority of the rule of law to rule by power. Secondly, the practice of judicial review. Thirdly, the separation of powers. And fourth, the assertion of fundamental human equality. Let me discuss each of those in turn. The rule of law. In contrast to any voluntarist assumptions about government and society, assumptions which inevitably lead to rule by power and by the strongest power, the American Constitution outlines a program for rule by law. And it's a program for rule by law, where law is always superior to political party or political power. It's a program that depends upon an intellectual appreciation of the greater likelihood of natural justice and objective fairness when all parties know in advance how the law is going to treat them. That is, it's a sense that there's going to be a tremendous fair play here, precisely because we will respect rule of law at all costs and not be changing the rules of the game when another party enters into power. And insofar as one thinks that the founders of our country, in establishing this system of government, envisioned plural parties which could operate even when power shifts occurred by fundamental rules of law rather than by a fundamental rule by power, this is a sense that intellectual appreciation of the demands of justice is what is envisioned by those founding fathers. And I think that it's very, very strong for how we conduct all the public business as well as the public restrictions and public regulation of private enterprises. Secondly, the notion of judicial review. I've called attention to this a number of times in our lectures. This is the power of some branch of government, the judiciary, to supervise legislation, to supervise another branch of government, and then to nullify anything that is inconsistent with the Constitution. Now, some people would say that that power of judicial review simply rests upon the assertion of various justices in our history. In fact, the matter is, it is nowhere explicitly stated in the Constitution, nor did any court in England explicitly have the power. We saw in the quotations I read earlier in this lecture that Blackstone and Cook had envisioned such a role, but no one court in England had the role which the U.S. Supreme Court eventually took to itself. Rather, the practice of judicial review was inaugurated by Chief Justice John Marshall, and the case that is rightly associated with the beginning of that practice is the 1803 decision in Marbury v. Madison. Even though the power of judicial review is not explicitly bestowed by the founders, nonetheless, I think you can make the argument that the power of judicial review flows from the nature of the judicial office. In England, I think that it was too often blurred with the notion of judicial legislation. But here, when they had separated the powers of government more strictly, this power has to belong to somebody if there's going to be an appropriate check and balance. And the alternative would be to say that only the executive checks the legislature by choosing what to enforce and checks the judiciary by appointing the powers of the judiciary itself. Now, this is an assertion by John Marshall, which I suspect flows simply from the nature of the judiciary. Now, in the course of our history, there have been various interpretations of how strong the power of judicial review should be. Many of the justices over the course of history have restricted themselves for testing whether statutory and administrative law, strictly speaking, conforms to the Constitution. So it's a purely formal test, and they don't employ any natural law standard over and above the formal test of does this conform to the U.S. Constitution. It's on that basis, I suspect, that something like Dred Scott was decided, where they refused to invoke a natural law standard and simply asked, does this law or does this law not conform to the U.S. Constitution? As such, this is in accord with the spirit of Blackstone, who I think was very much anxious that the courts would simply find a law which was in discrepancy with the Constitution, and then take it back to the legislatures to correct it. And so a much weaker sense of judicial review simply has the court in the role of identifying what is in some way inconsistent, but leaving the legislature to be the legislature. In other periods, jurists have assumed a much closer relation between the Constitution and natural law and have been much more willing to be activists in uprooting legislation that they thought in some way violated the law. The civil rights legislation of this century is a great example of that. The third and fourth matters where our Constitution reflects natural law. Third is the separation of powers into the distinct branches of government. This is indeed a new political idea. It's not something I think that any government had ever managed before our experiment. And yet the justification for so separating those powers comes with a sense that justice requires it and that this particular device will give us a better chance at keeping justice and avoiding rule by power. So the natural law sense of this is simply because natural law demands that there be justice, we need to devise some appropriate remedy so as more likely to ensure the actual conduct of the various powers of government, because power does tend to increase. Finally, there's a sense of inalienable rights, and we'll have occasion to discuss those as we turn to some other moral problems in the later part of these lectures. Here, I simply notice that even the Bill of Rights, beyond stipulating a number of personal and state rights, also in the Ninth Amendment goes on to say, "The enumeration of certain rights in this Constitution shall not prejudice other rights so enumerated," and a strong sense that there's a vigorous natural rights tradition here. We'll turn to further moral subjects in following lectures.